I want to say thank you. Thank you guys for having me, CMTC, for the warm welcome. It was nice to hear that. But I do appreciate it. I had a great time at the CNMI event. And from my perspective as a manufacturer, I learned a lot. Because there were a lot of expert and presenters. I think the other panelists today, Michael, is one of them. My perspective is as a small business manufacturer. I own a part of what's a family business in Rancho Cucamonga. We're not an aerospace company per se. We're a rubber manufacturer.
But do you make any components that go?
Yeah, I don't know the percentage. I have to walk through that. But it's somewhere, and it's growing. The amount of aerospace business we do is growing. You know, I see the business evolving. I've been with them for 15, 20 years now. And the picture of business that I see is evolving towards quality. I don't know how much of that is just our business or, you know, from the greater environment. But we see a lot more. We're doing more of aerospace and a lot more, you know, specialty type of parts. As I said before, I serve as information systems manager as well as supply chain manager. And a lot of small businesses are probably like that, but with a lot of people wearing a lot of hats. We don't have full-time IT staff or cybersecurity staff. We rely on consultants or just kind of picking up in-house and learning what we can do to what we have to do to protect ourselves. Also serve as supply chain manager. Goodyear Rubber Company in Southern California. We're not associated with Goodyear Tire. We're an independent manufacturer. We're a former of rubber products, I think is the best way to put it. We do some vertical integration, but our primary business is molding. We do some roll covering. I think that was what started, where we started, and was roll covering for the steel mills out in Fontana. We're an offshoot of the original businesses from the original Goodyear family, and that's where we get the name. It's actually established in 1872, but our facility since 1961. I think our first line of business was servicing the steel mills out there in Fontana. We do extrusion, all kinds of material, profiles, a lot of cable jacketing. Our biggest department is molding, injection molding, compression, transfer, all different kinds of materials. We've been, like I said, in Rancho Cucamonga since 1961. We've got about 140 employees. A lot of computers out there these days. We've got a lot of machinists, a few engineers, our office staff. But the evolution I've seen in the last 15, 20 years, a lot more computers out there on the floor. We're not a terribly complex, high-tech business. I say that we don't do a lot of multi-level assemblies, like maybe some aerospace companies. We're a former of rubber parts. And the evolution I've seen is still bringing in a lot of, the information systems, technology evolution. So even though we're not what I would call a high-tech business, we still see an influx of a lot of information system stuff. We've talked about, Internet of Things, email, everything connected to the Internet. And all that's exposure. I got into business kind of right when email seemed to be kind of taken over. We've got a lot of email accounts. That's what I just call our biggest gap. It's where we've seen, it's where we've been hacked a couple of times. It's a, you know, we know it. It's a great medium for communication. It's unauthenticated though. We all use it, and you all know anybody could. We could all be spoofed, and it happens. You know, information is key, and the problem with email, the way I see it, I administer our system, is we're trying to let every single email that's legitimate through. The other side of that coin is that, you know, in our effort to let those emails through, some of the bad emails will get through. Some of the hack attempts will get through. And then we're vulnerable. We're reliant on our employee, as well as our, you know, we'll talk about some of the kind of defense mechanisms to come in and save assets to mitigate, you know, the problem. So what we've seen, and again, when I'm talking basic level stuff. You know, not really enterprise level. The threats we've seen, we've encountered, they're like petty cyber criminal. We're not an aerospace company. I don't see, you know, other states, you know, some of the more serious risks or potential threats for our information. It could be a former employee, an IT consultant or something like that. Now, you know, on the aerospace side, you could get into people stealing secrets, you know, drawings and things like that. And I don't mean to downplay, downplay our information, because there always is proprietary information, there's formulas and things like that that are valuable. But at this point, really what we've seen is just random cyber criminal. And they've got the edge because they can take over some spamming some computer to send out a zillion, just like advertising, send out a zillion, you know, malware emails and just wait for one person to click on it. You know, literally they call it phishing. So your pool of attackers is huge. You know, former employee or competitor, that pool of potential attackers is very small. We haven't seen it. What we have seen is the petty cyber criminal just phishing and finding some hapless employee, you know, of ours. It's happened to me, not in a professional environment, but to click on an email. The way this has gone down for us, it comes in the form of an email. But you've all seen it. It looks like it's from someone you know, someone in your contact list. It could be anything. Our event where it's, we've actually had to pay a little ransom on it. It was about 3-4 years ago. And that's what happened. It was our controller. I'm about to open an email and download an attachment. And what we've seen with these malware, ransomware attacks, what I've seen anyways, the virus or the piece of software is loaded onto the computer, and it immediately, kind of blindly, maybe Mike will go into more detail on this, but just kind of reaches out for connected drives on the computer, and what we've seen is corrupting those files. So, you know, literally everything, PDF, spreadsheets, just start to locking them up, encrypting them, and then before long, you'll get a message on the PC, you know, this is the number to call, and, you know, we need you to pay us Bitcoin or something like that. And that's this particular attack, I'm talking about, it was a few years ago, we didn't have any real countermeasures in place. We didn't really have any of the solutions in place. So we were, we didn't have any gravity at this time, any leverage. So it was probably, you know, I'll talk a little bit about what I think is important for the employees is a culture of see something, say something. And what's important for me is that is the kindness of the essence. You know, it's critical that we can start mitigating things right away. In this case, I think the controller probably took her 10 minutes or so to know something was really wrong and get you know our information security people in there. But we know computers operate on milliseconds, and by that time enough of her files were corrupted that we were stuck. So like I said, she was a controller, didn't have any backup, had a lot of spreadsheets with important information, you know, for our company on it, and we were stuck, swimming in the ocean without our trunks on her. But so we ended up paying. I think the ransom was $500,000. It wasn't much for us in that case.
Did you say $500,000?
Oh, no, I'm $500,000
No big deal.
It doesn't, the risk, it outweighs what we ran into there a few years ago. I will say, I see the numbers. Depending on how you add it up, I've read that the average cost is up in the $30,000-some. We pay the ransom on, in this case, and like I said, it's pretty petty criminal stuff. But I think we all can imagine the severity, complexity of the attacks. Once this unknown software is downloaded, we don't know what it's going to do. It could be super sophisticated, and I imagine the stuff we've seen is, I said it would like blindly search out our eyes, but you can imagine a smarter actor, either a person or an artificially intelligent device, can search out real critical stuff. Depending on the level of the attack, human resource records. Potentially, the vendor or customer information. We hear about attacks, they send out like an invoice to your customer and try and get your customer to pay them. Intellectual property formulas, things like that. I haven't seen any of that. I've just seen run-of-the-mill ransomware, but potentially it could be very severe. It took about 10 minutes or so. We got the computer offline. You still run into the problem. I was thinking about this on the way over here. Once the computer's offline, you eliminate the threat, possibly, of infecting other computers on your network, but you still got your PC that virus is running rampant on. It took 10 minutes in our case, and like I said, we had to pay the ransomware. Some of the other stuff, we talked about the evolution of information systems. They say that it's about every 10 years there's a paradigm shift. in this type of stuff. We remember, you know, 20 years ago how PCs, you know, every year they double in capacity and speed. And then, you know, 10 years or so ago with the cell phones, all the flip tops, and now they're, you know, we're like encyclopedias for every piece of information that's ever been on Earth. And they make phone calls still. But the next kind of wave, and what I'm understanding, is the Internet of Things. Everything's connected. And, you know, we see that, you know, little devices at home. The things can be connected to the Internet. We saw the DDoS attack a few months ago. It was the first major one I had heard of where the Internet broke, for lack of a better word. But from what I understand, it was a lot of DVRs, things like that, connected to the Internet. All kind of this set up as this team of cyber warriors, nefarious cyber actors. And then at a given point in time, all sent requests to, I don't know, who one of the major Internet providers, servers, and essentially shut us down there for a few days, or something like that. But and that, I think, is, you know, where the IoT type devices, I hear they're, you know, working on a security platform for that to make it more secure. But I, you know, I really don't know. There's, you know, I talk about, you know, what's connected to our Wi-Fi at work. Everybody's got a cell phone these days. They're all connecting to the Wi-Fi. I don't really know the threat, but I guess that's just it. It's unquantifiable. So, you know, we are all somewhat exposed. I rely a lot. Yeah, I talk about the see something, say something culture. I think a lot of us, we're all internet savvy enough, but it's important that the employee knows that, you know, if they download something or something starts happening with their computer, that they say something and stop it. You know, in our company, we've got a small office staff and a lot of machinists. And these days, a lot of those out on the floor, there's a lot of email going on. And all the computers out there all connected to the Internet. But where we've seen attacks is in the office. People get compromised and open their funny-looking email. Tend to be people in the office that, you know, can happen to anybody. I guess that's what I'm saying. Okay, so security solutions. So since we got hacked and paid a ransom, we kind of had a wake-up call. We do very basic, some very basic security measures that have proven very effective the last few years. I was thinking about it. We haven't been really attacked that I've known of in the last year or so. We had one event where it was kind of a disaster because we were caught without any defenses. But if you put some of these basic security measures in place, we're basically able to, we've got leverage if we get attacked. We stop it, kind of isolate it, and then we go to our data backup. We use a local data backup as well as we've got an offsite. And they're really sophisticated. You guys, some of you probably know about how they work. They're very simple though. And it's almost out of the box, some of this stuff. That, when I say sophisticated, it's neat because it like creates an original backup set, and then you can go back to like a restore point at any day in the last 30 days. It's been sufficient for us. The local and the offsite work in very similar ways, and we've used both of them for everything from like event recovery, like a hacking event, to misplaced, lost files. We use them all the time. It's very simple. You got to be doing backup if you're not. We run antivirus. It's simple, but methodological about it. Right? We don't do any, we don't have any high price, you know, version of it. We run a basic, you know, security essentials type of thing. But we, one thing we do is real time backup, and I think that might be one of the delineators. The real time protection, it works just right on the spot. If the user clicks something that's in some log known hack type of file, they'll at least get a warning message through a quick line of defense. And what we've seen with antivirus is it slows down the attack. There was one instance my colleague was actually monitoring our server and kind of witnessed the attack happen. It was funny. It just went through, just alphabetically, through one of the drives. He saw it encrypting a group of files, then it would stop. Then go encrypt, kind of start where it's left off and stop. And it kept going, and after a minute or two, he's a fellow who helps out with a lot of the IT. He's more savvy in IT than myself. After a minute or two, he'd seen enough and pulled the plug. And when we got looking into it, we figured our antivirus would recognize it, kill it, but it would regenerate and then go, you know, encrypt a few more files before the antivirus would stop it again. But that, we were protected. We had backup, and it was no sweat. So this is some basic stuff. If you're not doing it, you need to be. Spam filter is for email. I talked about kind of the dichotic nature of email, where I want to let every legitimate business email through. The filters, although robust, are not perfect. There's a lot of gray areas. There's different methods for determining what spam and, you know, get ranked. A lot of spam emails we end up getting through. So we rely a lot still on employee education awareness. And it seems to be going pretty well for us. The firewall, we use that. That does a good job. I'd say we've got like 30 or 40 computers, many of them out there on the floor, many of them connected to the internet. It's just the way of things. I remember first coming into business, we'd have the big catalogs from, you know, all the supply companies, and those have been gone for 10 years now, it seems. But people are connected to the internet, and we just run a basic firewall that does some kind of won't let people from our network go to a whole host of sites. It seems to work. Monitoring response plan. There's stuff I've seen. It actually goes back to more of the education, where there's AT&T put out a couple of years ago just some animated shorts just to kind of keep kind of present scenarios for the average user employee, to see, you know, what might be, make them aware of what might be a bad email. And that's part of the monitoring response plan. Ideally for me, I don't have a better way to look at it than, you need to be able to actually monitor the server at all times. And I thought one of the questions I've got from Michael is, I know just enough about information systems. I'm really the only person in our company who to kind of think on that level. And I, knowledge of SQL and databases and things. Because our average, high level employee is putting things, we just see it on a spreadsheet, some kind of file. And those are exact. There's a number of reasons why I'm not really a proponent of that. A bunch of spreadsheets. I mean, they're good for what they are, worksheets. But in terms of storing and securing data, I just assume get it in a in a table and in a database so it's secure. I guess my question, or not so much a question, but where we store our data is important. And I'm a proponent of getting it in a database, and out of local files and things like that. Response plan for us is just we basically get it offline, and then we're kind of trying to see what happens.
What is your education entail? You've got 140 employees that you got to make sure they're up to speed on this. And so is it a biannual tutorial? You make them go over to remember, okay, this is what I, what is it that you give them?
It's a good question. And I don't have a perfect answer. I mean, a large part of it, I think, is a culture. Yeah, I rely a lot on that. I mean, we're more savvy. I'm not, I don't consider myself an IT professional. But we've been around the internet for 20 years now. In good business practice, the people, the computer's out on the floor. People aren't just searching the internet. And we got a good, strong firewall that keeps them, in a hopefully kind of somewhat secure range.
Some of it is constant vigilance. Lawrence Livermore did a seminar and presented all of this type of material and told the employees don't open these types of emails and that, and then about 3 weeks after that training, they sent a test email. 40% of these maniac people open the email. So it's constant vigilance, reinforcement, and change management.
Right? Yeah, and I know there's stuff that we're not implementing. And I know there's better education practices. What I did, we showed a couple of these videos. We put the focus on, instead of prevention, more almost mitigation, the things like the data backup, and the antivirus, make sure we learn real-time protection. Maybe those things, get those in place. We've done that, and then work on the education. I bet so much of us these days, we're all a little bit susceptible to it, but most of it, we should know, not to click on, suspect emails. But we don't have robust training programs or
It's interesting because just like what John was saying, even a lot of the other people I'm talking to, and we're talking about people in the Navy who have a lot of training, have the same problem. Especially they say something like 40% of the things happen to senior executives because they're so busy and they're so multitasking that at the same time that they're doing two or three things, they just accidentally clicked on that email. And so one of the key vulnerabilities is actually in the C-suite. It was right in the security level. So I know that's some of the things that Michael's going to address in a few minutes too.
I think the most catchwords are the purchase orders. Like when an email is like purchase orders, they just get this, and some of our sales teams, mostly the sales teams, because they don't want to miss that email, and they open it, and accidentally they're like, oh, and then what we had before was, as soon as they opened it, first they kind of deny. It's like, what do you do? Then now the IT is like trying to look for the root cause, like what happened, who did this, and you have like, 10 to 450 employees, you're going to have to look for everybody's computer and reboot it all. And so that's the hard part. And then finally they confess, or we find that as the root cause, and it's just a long process. So I think the backing up, what you were mentioning, is a really great idea. because then if that ever happens, yeah. But yeah, the purchase orders are the catchy ones. My sales team, they're all like, "Hey, purchase orders!" And then it's like, "Yeah, no, that's it." So.
Yeah, I could imagine that. We're a small company, but I could imagine it being real tough, the idea of having the confidence to step out and say something. It's easy when there's three or four people, but I can imagine a whole team, real competitive sales guys or gals, or not wanting to fess up and say I was the one at the subtask. But yeah, I guess a solid foundation in the backup and antivirus, so when it does happen, I guess that was, I think, on one of the headlines for this meeting was not if, but when.
Yes.
They're out there attacking. And it's the graph. I mean, it's you know, as information systems and IoT kind of explodes, you know, the world of cybercrime is going to increase. I mentioned our experience was we paid for virtually nothing. But you can imagine if it's compromised and you don't have a hedge, that could be very expensive very quickly to get things back online. I mean, you can imagine, you know, victims in the last year were reporting, you know, up to or over a month to recover, $32,000 of average loss. And still, I read that most companies take no preventative measures. And when I was looking back on this, it was just 3 years ago when we really first got hacked. It wasn't that long ago. It seems like it was forever ago. And our processes, we've adapted a little bit. But there still might be a lot of companies out there not doing anything. You know, I tend to think most aerospace companies, you probably are the head of the curve in terms of securing, you know, assets and resources.
So we had a question back here, and then I know we're going to have to get to Michael in a second.
Yeah.
So we do that. But he's got a question.
Thank you. So small businesses, we're finding more and more small businesses are running on their server. Essentially, their server is Dropbox or Box, you know, or some of these other, you know, software as a service systems. Done some Google searching while we've been sitting here on is Dropbox as an example secure. Some articles dating back to 2013, 2015, no, it's not. You look at Dropbox's website, absolutely secure. Any opinion on small companies using those as their server for HR files, as an example? I-9 forms, direct deposit forms, and other things like that.
My gut tells me no. I mean, I totally defer to Michael here.
Yeah, I'll address that.
Oh, very good.
But I can tell you no. If you put anything outside of your environment, make sure that that particular site has been independently certified by somebody else. So if it's PCI, you have a qualified security assessor who's certified the site and say, yeah, it's secure. Or if you have, say, what is called an SSA 16, CPA firms do what used to be called SAS 70. I think it's called SSA 16, and they'll certify based on agreed upon procedures, rules, and controls in place that you rely on. That still doesn't mean you are not responsible. You can steal your data in the event of a breach. It is still your data, and you chose to use that particular firm or that particular site. So you have to weigh the risk and figure it out. The more control you have over your data, the better.
Thank you.
Let's share just a quick law scenario. One of our clients called in about a month ago saying that they were finished and they had an accounts payable loss, which was covered by the insurance that we provide. But here's how it went down. They buy a product from outside of the United States. The controller here locally has the wire instructions and the contact name. He receives an email from that same company, from that same individual with the same footer on his email, saying, "Here's, we moved our facility to XYZ location. Here's the new wire instructions." He clicks the button, $100,000.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So, phishing accounts fell for him. I would say over the last year, probably about half of our clients have called in with some loss scenario, either denial of service or malware, saying, you know, do we have coverage? What do we do? A multitude of different issues.
Yeah, it makes you want to get back to paper. And,
and the recent local one that you can see in the paper is LA Valley College got hacked. Ransomware for $28,000 this week, and they weren't going to be able to start class or have the class schedules for all the students up there. So that just made the paper, and now the news is bubbling about why and how could this happen.
Now, don't rely on just insurance. Like you get cyber insurance, and you say, well, okay, I'm covered. Okay, but now the insurance company is saying, well, wait a minute. Yeah. Did you have proper controls? It's like you insure your car, but if the insurance company investigating your car theft realizes that or finds out that you left the key in the station and the door was open or unlocked or the window down and you had something on the front seat that attracted people who want to get it, I mean, they're going to say, you don't want to get it, I'm going to cover you. Same thing. So you got to be, you have to at least have prudent controls. And then, by the way, you don't mind getting started?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to just kind of say one thing. Some of you are probably aware of it, but there's a new car that is by the end of this year. Is it the entire government or just DOD? Do you know, Marty?
You segregate the firewall, your defense-related data. We're doing that, by the way.
If you want, so it's just DOD right now?
So TSA and NASA.
Yeah. By the end of this year, if you want to do business with those agencies, you must conform to the FAR or they won't do business with you. Okay. Boeing and Airbus are not far behind. Mm-hmm. And clearly, this is the tip of the iceberg, because clearly, if you want to do business with the government, period, at some point, you're going to have to conform to this FAR on cybersecurity.
And we've received letters from Raytheon already, because we do defense partnership too.
So, just so you know, it's not something, you know, I think as you said, most small businesses are, well, you know, I don't want this small, I don't need to deal with it. But in Southern California, most of the companies doing in A&D are small businesses. And they're going to find themselves out of business if they don't take this seriously.
You'll lose the government contract. And this is exactly what I'm going to talk about now. So if you don't, great segue, thank you. And will they get a copy of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, if you give us a copy of the slides, we'll post it on the website.
I really don't mind.
Okay, good.
Okay. Because this is not a secret. In January 2010, Obama put out an executive order talking about classified national security information to be taken in a certain way. And he also, subsequently to that, issued another executive order that defined what's called controlled unclassified information. This is for government contractors like you or OEMs that deal with, have government contracts that deal with data that needs to be protected in certain ways. So what they did is they defined CUI and they told you how to protect it. And so, and here, I blew it up so you can see it, you'll get to read it later. If you are an OEM or a federal contractor, okay, these are the rules that you have to, like FARs or DFARs for defense. There's some others, but these two in particular are the ones that I think, especially the last one, are the ones that I think affect you most. 53 has, I think there's a larger number, and I'll show you, they're called control families that you need to be in compliance with. 171 are for SMBs, the small to medium sized businesses. And this is what you were referring to, is that you have to be compliant with 171R1 by the end of December 31st, 2017, this year. If you're not, then you have to explain why you're not. And if it's not a sufficient reason or good enough reason, you could lose the contract, the government contract. So for small businesses, the challenge is, I'm not a big bank where I have a large infrastructure or a lot of capital where I can install all the tools for monitoring, for protection, and the like. So how do we do it? So what we're doing is we're working with CFTC to come up with a solution. This is, I've been working with CUI. In this particular website, and again, I provide you the URL. If you go to archive.gov, CUI, and go to the CUI registry, this gives you everything that's considered CUI. And you probably fall in one of these categories. Okay, and that would be either manufacturing, procurement, acquisition, whatever it is, or defense. But one of these you fall into, and then it will define what is CUI and how you need to protect it. The way you protect it is based on 74, 53 and 70, and 171. These are the 26 control families in 53, and each one of them has at least 10 to 25 different individual test procedures that you need to prove you're compliant with. These are for larger institutions. Okay, this is what you call it. Okay, there's 14 families here, and it is, which is a subset of that, a subset of 53. But access control, you know, how you identify yourself, how you authenticate who you are with an ID password or say a token or multi-factor authentication, and then once I've been authenticated, then what do I have access to? That's access control. How do I protect my servers? How do I protect my network? Firewalls is one thing. In IT, they're called layer 3 devices. Any network devices are a firewall, router, switch, web application firewall, load balancer, all of those. I've been doing this since 1978, and I grew up when computers were in one room. There was no laptops. As a matter of fact, the IBM PC was Man of the Year on Time Magazine in 1981. So that was before then. Today, it's everywhere. Everything talks to everything. And so it's very difficult to control, they say. But it is easy to control, because technology has grown. The security features have grown with the technology. The problem is you and me. We don't turn things on. The control features are there, but all of those controls are installation collected. And you don't turn them on because they're in your way, you slow things down, you don't want to bother with them. Or no one's watching it because, hey, I'm not heavily regulated, so nobody really cares about me until you get breached. Then it's important. Okay. But technology has kept up with security, has kept up with technology. Again, which is fine. That's why I'll always be in business. There'll always be work for me because people just don't turn things off.
Yes. So both of you have mainly talked about PCs. But a lot of people can go work on this.
Absolutely.
And you know, you've got Office on this, you've got email on this, you've got a web browser on this,
yes,
all that stuff. And I haven't heard much about what's the security around this.
There are many tools. There's one called, there's a series of tools called MDM. That's Mobile Device Management Systems. And what they do, they can control, and most of you don't, maybe you haven't heard of them or haven't installed them, but mobile device management systems will allow you to control, keep an inventory of all your mobile devices. Whatever iOS it is, or if it's Galaxy or Apple, whatever it is. It will also protect things on your laptop, on your mobile device, to separate corporate from personal. That evolved when people were bringing your own device. And say, I want to use, especially executive, I want to use my own iPhone to use it for work as well. I don't want to have two, like Hillary, I don't want to have two devices. And I don't have two mobile devices, one device. Well, with MDM, I can separate my baby pictures and my corporate stuff. Okay? I can also control what apps you can get to from your iPhone. If you don't want someone to get into social media, Twitter or Facebook or whatever it is, or you can restrict it only to certain people during a certain amount of time. You can also manage the GPS where I can always locate where you are, and then send a kill switch in the event that it gets stolen. So there's a lot of things you can do with it now. Again, these are tools that are available, have been available for several years now, but people just don't buy them or use them because they feel either they don't know about them or it's expensive. Okay, so but again, yes, absolutely. And that's now, again, growing up in audit and security, my biggest concern was IT and executive management wouldn't pay attention to control. And so what we have now is, with the advent of Enron and the major breaches that occurred, and by the way, I was a partner at Anderson in L.A., not Houston. I was there for 9 years in L.A., and it was a wonderful program, by the way. But it's gone. But regardless, I saw the evolution of regulations such as Sarbanes-Oxley that requires certain controls over financial reporting, Fiducia, the FDIC Improvement Act, and things moved on. Now with NIST being now required for manufacturing and others, it is a burden, but to me it's a godsend. Because now I can say, okay, now I can use PCI, now I can use SOX, now I can use NIST as leverage to get the right controls in place where in the past they just wouldn't care. And they, even now, I do PCI assessments for large companies. If you don't know what PCI is, the payment card industry, the five card brands, Amex, American Express, Discover, MasterCard, they have a data security standard that if you do any, if you transact any credit card activity, whether it be web, kiosk, card swipe, dip, whatever it is, they have to be certified. And if they get not certified, they can conceivably take your card produce away, and that could be devastating for a company. So I do those assessments, and I'm realizing that it's important for them to install these controls, but they invariably will say, what do I need to do just to pass? It's not the mindset. The mindset is not, what do I need to do to be secure? But what is it to just to pass the certification? Okay, and unfortunately, that's what happens.
I just want to buy the tickets to the dance.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, and that happens, and I understand that because I've been there. I understand. I understand what that means. I grew up in First Interstate, Security Pacific. If you remember that, Pacific Bank, yeah, Wells Fargo. I grew up in those environments in banking. But when I got into public accounting, I then got into manufacturing and other industries, and I realized there are SMBs that can't afford to implement all the controls that I had the luxury of implementing. How do we deal with that? Well, there's ways to deal with it and still comply. And the way we do that, and I always share that with you. And by the way, I was going to show this to you. This is a tool that just came out that allows us to do the assessments, and you can do it yourself if you know how. Let me jump straight into this here.
While you're jumping into that, let me go back to the one question. I hate to phrase it this way, because I don't have a great deal of faith in the mainstream media, but I don't hear a lot of hacking on phones. Is that because no one's aware of it, or it really hasn't matured to that point?
No, I think more it hasn't. Well, the phone is being used for personal things, like
right.
You can read checks and deposit them. You can, but see, they're not going to go after you. I mean, if they go after you or me, that's not where the money is.
Limited treasure.
It's limited, yeah, because they'll do a one-up. And, you know, what are they going to gain?
Right.
The best thing to do is to go after companies and go after credit cards, either hot, large number of credit cards for individuals, you know, many credit cards, and you sell them in the underground, you know, for, you know, $3-4 a piece, and you still make a mint, or go for corporate cards. So I can go into a company, and those typically don't have credit limits. I mean, I can use them. There are all kinds of things, right? So, yeah, they're still susceptible to being hacked. But that's not where the hackers are going to go. They're going to go, they want to make some money and quit. Okay?
You call that risk reward.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to this one. I want to speak to you. This is how I view security. Okay. On one side, you have controls, and NIST 53, 171, HIPAA, GLBA, PCI, they all have control requirements. And unfortunately, what happens, sometimes you get security specialists, they don't understand business. You just get a techie, he'll go after the controls, and you've got to have this in place. And then you wind up over-controlling, because on the other side, you don't have, the risks aren't there. So, the type of control that you can impose is preventive control, which means you stop something from happening close before the entry. That's the most effective. You have detective control where you have an audit trail so you can find out who did what and when and to what. And then corrective is to put it back to the point where it was before the incident occurred. Now, a directive control are more policies, training, that kind of thing. So you have these type of controls and you can effectively group everything that I showed you in the previous slide into these four types of controls. On that side, you have risks. Now, when I was an auditor, we would find that the risks outweigh the controls. So we impose more controls. But if I don't understand the business, I wind up over-controlling or spending money I don't have. I don't have to. Okay. The type of risks vary depending on your industry and what your business model is like. You know, what's important to you. If you get 50 executives like yourselves and we sit in a room and you say, what keeps you up at night? And what do you want as part of your business? Then they say, we want to be the best in our industry. They actually won't say that. But we want to have the center of excellence in whatever. Or we want to, whatever. I mean, all of these things that we all want to do have state-of-the-art technology. That's not what's important to them. What's important to them, and I think you'll agree with me, is we want to maximize shareholder wealth. That's really why we're in business. And so if you don't understand the strategic business objectives, you wind up over-controlling things. If you understand, that's where security comes in. And it has to be commensurate to the risks, whatever controls you can put in place. So the type of people that you want to handle your security are people that are not just technologists, but understand why it's important. Now let's go back to this, and then I'll be on the phone. The things that you'll encounter, you have to be compliant by the end of December 31st of this year. And you don't have to hire up the entire, whatever you want. But you have to bring somebody in to help you go through all of those test procedures and filter out based on a risk assessment that this gives us, and filter out those controls that do not apply to you. Once you've identified all the controls that apply to you, then you need to make sure that they're in place. And they're the same in security and compliance. If it's not documented, it doesn't exist. Okay? So you have to have the control, but you have to document it. So when the FISMA people come in, or the government comes in, or an auditor comes in, he looks at it and he says, okay, I need to prove it. And then you have the proof, you have the evidence, and you show it to them. Okay. And then they can issue your approval to operate.
And the insurance too, right?
And the insurance as well. Yeah, the insurance company now is coming and saying, okay, you want $5 million of coverage or more. Then the more you have, they're going to want to say, well, what kind of controls do you have? Did you have an independent assessor come in to certify you? Show it to me. and if not guilty, they'll send it over.
Is this assessment, is this getting like ISO assessment then? So there's a bunch of because I don't expect the government to go into every one of these small companies that are up. And but somehow they got to get some validation that that company meets the NIST requirements. So is it a third party that's setting itself up like the ISO auditors?
ISO needs to have an accredited auditor to do the ISO, like the 9000. ISO 27000 is the cybersecurity ISO, the security.
Is that matching the NIST requirements, or is that something different?
No, that's something different.
Okay.
I rarely find people who need the ISO except for an international.
But my question was, is who's validating, like for ISO? You know, I can see a piece of paper that an independent authorized auditor has said, your ISO is certified, I've done an audit. Is there an equivalent for the NIST?
Yeah, you have someone internal or someone independent to do the NIST SP171 assessment using their model or the CT tool that NIST gives you. You run through it. You submit it to the agency that you have direct impact,
okay.
Whether it be NSA or DOD, they will then give you an approval to operate,
okay.
An ATO. Or they give you an IATO, which is an interim approval to operate because you are not compliant. Or they will give you a DATO, which means what? And denial to operate. So you don't want that one. Okay. Now that will happen in the event that you have major or gross error vulnerabilities, or that you haven't really come up with a way to remediate them, or whatever they just are not satisfied with. And they'll come in, and that's when they come in and say, okay, show me what you've got. Show me what you've got. Okay, and what you don't have. Because they don't really want to lose you, but they can't, but again, it's a loss. Okay. Here's the other rub against in this discussion is that if you, as an OEM, also use another vendor, okay, you then issue them an ATO. Okay, because they're effectively supporting you to support a government agency. And many times we forget about those guys. Those guys also, depends on how big they are and how critical their service or product is to you. If it's important enough that it would affect your ATO with that agency, then yeah, they need to prove to you that they are compliant with 171 or 53 or whatever it is that you're being basic things. Okay. That's where you're at. And I don't know if you are thinking about it, it's important that you start now. It's going to happen real fast. The end of January, the end of December is going to be just around the corner.
So, Michael, how long do you say a process would take if somebody undertook the idea to become compliant because they need to? How long does it take?
Okay. If you talk to someone, and again, this is not supposed to be a sales thing. I really don't want to do this because I'm just working with him. But if you talk to anyone, and I know Moss Adams, Moss Adams does this kind of work as well. Because they're a PCI.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've met you guys, you're great. If they come in and tell you that it's going to take 18 months to do the assessment, no. Because you're not that big. And again, the risk isn't there. But you still need to be compliant. Okay, so what you need to do is you need to do a risk assessment to figure out what applies to you. Then they need to do a test, effectively a gap assessment, so they identify all the areas where you're not compliant. Then they have to come up with remediations on each one of them to put it into compliance, and then they have to be retested. So the question is, how long does it take? It shouldn't take more than a couple of weeks to do the gap assessment, the risk assessment of the gap, but I can't tell you what it would take to get the assessment or the certification, because you may have no problems, or you may have a lot of problems. And if you do have a lot of issues where you're not compliant, it's going to take time to remediate. And what it's going to cost to get you to where you are compliant, it just depends on what tools you have. You need tools for access control, for monitoring, and that would be the web, that would be the legacy, the databases. We talked about risks earlier. You have a SQL database. You say, well, you know, I've got data that's secure on the database. It's better than putting it in a file share or a shared server or where everybody can get to it or on a laptop. Yeah. So what happens is, if that database sits behind a web app that faces the outside, I can send SQL injections through that website and issue a command called SP underscore command shell, and it'll go through the SQL database and then allow me to issue a DOS command from the database from the outside if I don't have proper control. I see that all of the time because we say, well, I've got the database secure, the file server is hardened, nobody can get to it, but you've left the window open and people just don't think about it. And that's how people get it. Okay? So anyway, if you don't have those proper controls, then you need to figure out what tools don't I have. And that's where the money comes in. There are open source tools that are free, nothing expensive, that you can install, but where it's not free is that you now have to have people who are skilled and trained on how to install it, how to use it. That's what it can cost you. Or you can outsource it to a managed service provider and let them do it. Okay, that's a good idea. But maybe that's cost prohibitive as well. So you got to figure out what's best for you. Okay. Many times people have IT departments, and they say, well, we want to outsource. So you outsource, lay them off, outsource to somebody else. And you say, you know what, that's not working. Well, all that intellectual capital went out the door when you laid those people off. You got to start building it all over again. It gets really heavy. So you got to figure out what is the right thing for you.
Yes, question. Could you talk a minute about your thoughts? We're choosing new ERP systems.
Yeah.
Some of them are cloud based.
Yes.
The software that I'm designed with you is.
Right.
Okay. Your thoughts about the security nature of those systems? Because we do have a lot of you who do build for sure.
If you have Azure or AWS, the Amazon Web Services, those cloud-based service providers, they're very good. They've got very robust, strong controls. But I go back to my point earlier. I have a lot of clients with AWS and Azure, but they don't install it correctly. And so what happens is they're subject to breaches because they don't activate logging, they don't activate the intrusion detection or prevention systems that come with the tool. Okay, so it just depends on how they are. Okay. Being on a cloud is not inherently bad. It's how the cloud service provider implementation, how the cloud, it's called virtual private cloud. The virtual private cloud has been installed for you, okay? Whether you or you hire someone to manage that for you, how that's being monitored. So again, it just depends. Now, ERP packages are what used to be individual applications all over, right? Well, the problem with ERP packages is you wind up reorganizing your company to fit the package. And you know, that's the other one. Whether it be SAP or, you know, GE Edwards or, but now if it's on the cloud, it's so different. You just have to think, okay, make it work for you. Okay, and then make it sure it's secure. Separation of duties, proper access control, RBAC, role-based access control. People are allowed access only to the extent that they need to do their job. It's security is called principal needs privilege. Granted only the level that you need. Anything else? You got to have more questions.
Yeah. I have a question. Going back to you talked about backup. So,
yes.
My background is electrical engineering, yep. But I help out a lot with IT at IMS. And one of my questions is, what if you have a continuous backup program? So as you save or edit files, that file is automatically backed up. But at the same time, you have some corruption or virus going on. And then, is that once you get into the backup, and how does that affect the rest of the files in the backup?
The answer to that is probably yes. If you have a virus and it gets infected, or in the truth, what you back up does come back.
Is there anything you can do? Because that's essentially what you're seeing. What's supposed to be there?
But your AV, okay, your AV software should catch that before you back it up. AV is antivirus and anti-malware. Antivirus and anti-malware is effective and very good as long as it's current, which means that somebody's not been updating those signature files on a continuous basis. Those signature files have to be current. The scans have to be scheduled periodically, typically once a week, full scans with maybe partial scans every day. The downloads of those files, for me, I prefer once a day at a particular time when nobody's around, like 2 o'clock in the morning, to let it be done. The problem is the mobile devices. Mobile devices, you're going to be home, you probably won't have it up, and it won't get safe to get back in. But to me, AV and anti-malware is fiction. But if you don't have that installed all across the board, then yeah, it's going to get into your backup, it's going to be a problem. Anything else? Yes.
I like the analogy of scale, control versus risk. Just a quick story about it came from trying to infrastructure for the last 5 years. I was there. Did a lot of military stuff, a lot of military specs and controls and data and all. We found that we hadn't locked down a lot of things. We kept getting corrupted over and over and over again. To the point they detected it, that they would allow screensavers, everybody could have their own screensaver. There was no branding that said client systems across or any type of thing. And they opened all of the ports for you to use thumb drives everywhere. In the entire factory and out on the upper offices, and they found out guys wanted to have their own beautiful picture of the 56 Chevy as their scrolling screen shaver, and they bring in thumb drives and they have corrupted stuff on it, and they disinfect the entire system. So they clean it all up, and then the very next day, you back on it. So you got one of those 56 Chevy scrolling on the and it had the Trojan horse virus or some such thing in the background. And I will say that it is very real at this level. I now work for a company that does composites for radar evasion stealth aircraft. We get barraged all the time by Chinese, Russian, Korean people trying to get to our specs. Drawings, data, we've had ransomware, it's very, very real.
I am a contributing writer for Search Security. You go to searchsecurity.com and just pull up my name and get about 100 articles in here. The focus of the articles are cybersecurity. But the questions come up a lot. Is it ransomware? Or do we pay? Is it ethical or is the right thing to pay for ransomware? And how do I prevent it? Right? Backups is the way you prevent it. Because if they encrypt your data, okay, who cares? I got my back. I can restore from my backup. But if you don't do proper backups, then you've got a problem. But there's a lot of issues. Basic, what I'm finding is if you just do the basic controls, you're going to be okay. I was CISO at Newegg. You guys know Newegg?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, see, I was CISO there for, CISO is Chief Information Security Officer. I was there for 5 years. And We used to get hacked or attempts, a million DDoS attacks a day. A million. Okay? 24,000 web attacks a day. Alright? Because we're a big target. I suspect you may or may not be a big target because they either don't know about you, or if they do find out about you, they're going to go after you. This is who you are, and I really don't know who you are.
Yeah.
I suspect you'd be a government contractor, it's the same security. That's good. But the way I had it was, is I had an intrusion prevention system that front-ended, we call the Bastion, that front-ended our internal network and the internet. And I needed an IPS to handle all that traffic and threw it away. And then it went, and then once it came through, then I had a series of firewalls. Okay, no, I'm sorry, load balancer that routed the traffic evenly so I won't get hung up. And then each one of the subnets had a firewall to handle, you know, what kind of indiscriminate what was going to go through. You design your network environment to handle your business and to handle your traffic, but also to handle your risk. And how that's done, your network folks need to have an understanding of what risk is and what's important to you. Some of the things that are important to you are things like what made you who you are, drawings, source code, intellectual property or capital that is important to you, that if somebody were to steal that, your business is gone. That's the risk assessment that needs to be done so you can protect it. And put the proper level of protection and only allow people who have access. And with those who do have access, you have it locked. You know who did it and who gained access to it. Those are the controls. And a lot of that is really simple, not common sense. Right. And, I'm more than willing to stay as long as you want, so if you have more questions.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, I'll just mention something that a person that's an ADC or who is very knowledgeable about counterintelligence, let's just put it that way. And he shared with me something. He says, if somebody goes down to Best Buy and they buy a new laptop, and it's an IP address that has never been touched before, within 7 minutes of attaching that to the internet, that brand new IP address has been scanned by a malicious actor, and then it's on the dark web. A brand new IP address is only 7 minutes until it's known. I have a feeling this guy knew what he's talking about.